Welcome back to Current Account. I'm your host, Clay Lowry, Executive Vice President here at the Institute of International Finance. On Current Account, I try to talk about what I see as some of the more important current issues in international finance and economics while providing my own U.S. politics and policy angle on these different issues when it is appropriate. On this week's Current Account, I'm talking with my colleague, Martin Casiano, who's the head of Latin American research here at the IIF, about the Mexican economy, as he just returned from an investor trip in the country where he met with officials, other investors, and private sector actors. One of the main reasons we want to talk about Mexico is that it's an economy that is very important in the world. It's one of the top G20 countries. It actually had one of the best growth rates of G20 countries last year. And maybe just as importantly, they're coming into their election season. In fact, I believe that the campaign for their presidency started on March 1st. So I think that's right after Martin left the country. So Martin, let's start with economics and finance. You just returned from Mexico. You led this investor trip with a number of our member firms. What were some of the main takeaways you had from the conversation?
Thank you, Clay. It's a pleasure to be with you. Yes, I led the recent IIF in-person investor trip to Mexico City, where we met with government officials, local market participants, as you said. This included people not only from the financial sector, but also from a variety of industries and different backgrounds, ranging from the energy sector analysts to political experts. So first, let me say that the general mood we found in Mexico was positive. I would put the optimism somewhere between moderate to significant right now. That's driven mainly by favorable growth momentum and also increased nearshoring opportunities. There is a lot of talk about nearshoring. Growth surprised on the upside last year, above 3%, which is historically high. The long-term average for Mexico is below 2%, so activity has been very strong. There has been a deceleration in the last quarter, but high frequency indicators suggest the economy has regained traction recently on the back of fiscal stimulus, mostly pre-election spending, and also improved external conditions. So the economy is on strong footing, very tight labor market, and that's mainly due to domestic consumption and investment, both public but also private. I mean, we have seen a pickup in private investment, and that's no longer a drag on growth in Mexico. We have been more positive on growth for a while, but also market participants, I think, now have recently upgraded their 2024 growth forecast as well. So growth is said to be above 2% this year, thanks mainly to domestic demand, sizable minimum wage increases, better than expected external demand as well, this nearshoring activity, and also heavy pre-election spending. The peso has remained very strong. Inflation has come down significantly. Although when we look at services inflation, it has stabilized at a high level above headline inflation and above the target, and that's a concern of the central bank. Another positive part of the story is that this stronger economy has not resulted in a wider current account deficit. Normally, when the economy is growing fast, imports go up and the trade balance deteriorates, and that means higher external financing needs. That's not has been the case. We have seen import compression, a recovery in the trade balance, particularly non-oil, and a reduction in the current account deficit that was close to zero last year. So that means lower pressure on external accounts and on foreign reserves as well.
Okay, just for one clarification. So nearshoring, some people might not know what that term is. So nearshoring is an idea when the Trump administration and then the Biden administration, particularly in the United States, put tariffs on China, that could you actually find different sources of imports that were actually near to the shores of the United States? So that's kind of the idea of nearshoring. And it's interesting that U.S. imports of Chinese goods is down fairly significantly over the last few years. They're also up in Mexico, which leads one to believe that China actually is exporting some other goods through Mexico to get to the United States. So I think that's what you mean by nearshoring, but correct me if I'm wrong on that, Martin. But let me ask a slightly different question, which is, so you gave us a fairly positive view actually a very positive view? Or were there any negatives that you took away, or concerns or vulnerabilities that you see that some of the investors would be worried about when they're looking at Mexico?
Yeah, so I would say that there are four things that investors should keep an eye on. The first one is nearshoring and actually its growth implications, because there is different consensus on the different views on the impact on growth. So we can discuss about that. The second is monetary policy action in the coming months. Also, there are two camps there in terms of what could happen. That's another source of investor concern. The third one is Pemex, as the company faces the risk of debt restructuring. And the last one is, of course, the upcoming election and the policy shifts by the next administration. On nearshoring, it's very challenging to identify in the data. The views vary significantly among the market participants, but there is consensus that firms are already preparing, as you said, to expand export capacity to the U.S., anticipating that the country will benefit from this trend. People agree that nearshoring potential could be constrained by logistics, infrastructure, electricity, and even water shortcomings in Mexico. So this could make the process very gradual, but it seems like it's something that is unavoidable. I mean, it should help Mexico grow faster in the coming years, regardless of the policy framework in place. Of course, there's going to be competition from other countries in Latin America, for instance, that they also have some sort of free trade agreement with the U.S. That competition is going to be very tough, and it will push the next administration to deliver policy improvements. My take on this is, after all the conversations that we have, is that Mexico is already benefiting from it. It will continue to benefit, but I would say at a moderate pace compared to the potential. And this is because of the policy outlook, and we can talk more about that later, and also the implications of the U.S. relationship with Mexico and also with China. The second theme is monetary policy. I mean, markets analysts believe that the central bank will adjust the monetary policy ahead of the Fed, delivering a 25 basis points cut in March, basically acknowledging that interest rates are just too high in real terms. However, it remains unclear if this would be the beginning of the easing cycle, or the central bank will pause again in May, right ahead of the election, and reassess the inflation dynamics. There is big discussion about the different factors playing out, like the timing for Fed easing, actually, the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank monetary policy easing, the ability to anchor inflation expectations by the Central Bank of Mexico, the stickiness of core prices, services inflation, also even the estimates of the neutral interest rates, that should be revised given the recent changes in the economy. And a key factor is fiscal policy. The government is going through a very large fiscal expansion. Fiscal deficit is going to be around 5% of GDP, the largest since the early 90s. And that would mean a significant adjustment in 2025 by the next administration, about 3 percentage points of GDP. Very tough to achieve. And that could affect inflation, the outlook for inflation, and also affect monetary policy. The opinions among the different analysts on the impacts on this issue seem to be highly divided. Our view is that monetary policy easing will kick off in March, but the central bank will remain very vigilant because mainly of increased fiscal spending and the impact of that on inflation and inflation expectations. Also, the capital flows picture in Mexico has been very weak. In recent years, it has remained weak this year, particularly on portfolio flows. We have seen portfolio outflows. FDI remains below the average for a Latin American country. So the central bank will also have to keep an eye on financial stability, which is a part of its mandate. So under these conditions, and assuming a prudent U.S. monetary policy stance, we don't expect the central bank will be able to cut more than 150 basis points this year, which is less than what markets are currently pricing in. And the third issue is Pemex.
Okay, Martin, thank you. That's very helpful on monetary policy. And I know you made a third point, which is about Pemex, which I'm going to ask you to talk about right now. But I think it's important for everybody to know what Pemex is. Pemex is a Mexican-based energy-producing company, and it is state-owned. And so, therefore, it becomes a big part of how the government does its policy. over the many years, there's been talk about privatizing it or not privatizing it. The current government has made it pretty clear that they want no desire to privatize it. It's sort of a national entity or a government-backed entity. And so for that reason, it has very important aspects for fiscal policy as well as other, not to mention energy policy, of course. Martin, you mentioned Pemex.
I mean, the state-owned company has weighed increasingly on fiscal accounts. We have seen declining oil production and high levels of debt. There is a large amount of Pemex total debt that matures in the next 6 to 12 months. That reflects very high rollover risk. Market participants think that the next administration will be more pressured to open the energy sector to private investment and also Pemex, but financial assistance by the government will continue. The issue there is that the margin to do so by the next administration will be narrow because the social programs have taken up most of the fiscal space. We heard very interesting things down there about what could be done if there is political will to do so. That includes investing in electricity, exploring opportunities to sell some of the fields, exploring opportunities in natural gas. I mean, Mexico, about 50% of the electricity in Mexico is generated by gas, and 80% of the gas comes from the U.S., so the dependence is very high, monetizing emission reductions, as many other oil firms are doing, pursuing farm outs. But of course, all this requires political support, a forceful policy shift, which in my view is unlikely to happen in the near term.
And so the fourth point you had said was the election. So let me just a quick 2 seconds on background here on the elections. Mexico will run its presidential election in early June. There are two major candidates. They are both women, and there's never been a woman president in the history of Mexico. One is Claudia Sheinbaum, who is essentially a protege of the current president, better known as AMLO, from the Morena Party, and she's the former mayor of Mexico City. As far as I can tell, she has not just a big lead, but a huge lead over Senator Xochitl Galvez, who is from more of the business-oriented, kind of more conservative part of the Mexican political scene. There's still a few months left before this election will be decided, but right now those seem to be the two major candidates. So how do you see those elections going forward, Martin? And as you mentioned, this could be a risk or a vulnerability to the overall economic situation in Mexico.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's what we heard about the election is that the baseline is that the ruling party will win the upcoming election. Although the race is still open, as you said at the beginning, the presidential campaign has just started. It looks like it's going to be a two-candidate race. So that means that the margin could quickly change. Also, the pre-election polls are not that reliable in Mexico. So there is agreement that the race is still open. If the baseline holds, I mean, under a new administration, the same ruling party, most people see that policies will remain broadly unchanged before they gradually start becoming friendlier to private investment. People see negotiations with the opposition will be harder under the Sheinbaum administration, and also negotiations with the U.S. government will become more complicated. There is a tail political risk that the ruling party gets a significant amount of votes, gets enough votes to be able to pass constitutional reforms, getting a supermajority in Congress in order to pass constitutional reforms. There have been proposals by the current administration already in place, very controversial, and these proposals could undermine some of the economic and political institutions. But the probability of this scenario is quite low, I would say. Also, considering the U.S. election this year, even though the candidates are well known, we have USMCA that should help contain some of the sort of trade policy uncertainty. Analysts think that we could see significant discussions about trade and immigration that could lead to exchange rate volatility. Also, the USMCA, it will likely be revised in 2026, so that could be another source of uncertainty. In terms of the next administration policy changes, I think there is a bit of wishful thinking in the market regarding what the next administration in Mexico would be willing to do and also would be able to deliver in terms of market-friendlier policies. I think we are going to still have a center-left approach that will be maintained, even though we are going to see more pressure to deliver pro-market policies. Macroeconomic policies will also be maintained. We could see maybe weaker commitment to fiscal austerity. We could see improvements in macroeconomic policies like public management, for instance, renewable energy, transportation, but we won't see a radical Pemex reform, in my view. The other thing is that the margin of victory is going to be very important. That would help the next president in the negotiations with the opposition and also with the U.S. government in terms of having strong political support. And the final source of uncertainty is the relationship with the current administration that the next administration will have. I mean, that could constrain the policy shift, particularly at the beginning of the new term. So those are kind of my main takeaways on the political prospects.
Okay, thank you, Martin. So you covered some of the kind of the relationship between Mexico and the United States, and I think you're pretty clear. There's uncertainty there, first of all. I mean, the U.S. has its own elections, which could create different relationships. Maybe just a little more on that. When you were on your investor tour, did they talk about that a lot? Was there also a conversation about Mexico's relationship with China, particularly given some of the nearshoring you were mentioning earlier? And then any just kind of summary points that you'd like to kind of close out with?
Yeah, sure. I think, as you said, nearshoring, also the USMCA, that's kind of a good framework to improve the relationship between the US and Mexico. There are many opportunities from global geopolitics and the changes that we have seen on supply chain due to COVID. That has led to more compact, shorter, more integrated operations, and that should benefit Mexico and the US. In general, I would say Latin America is well positioned to take advantage of this, not only this global supply chain reshuffling, but also its location away from major conflicts in the world and the rebalancing of capital flows. Mexico, I think, is the best positioned country to benefit from the large U.S. markets. Corporates are highly integrated. Remittances by migrant workers remain very high. FDI is the point, the weakest link, I would say. So far, we have not seen a significant activity there, but firms are clearly preparing to expand capacity, particularly in the northern states. We have heard about truck traffic at the border increasing, machinery and equipment imports are also going up. At the same time, as you said, Mexico's imports from China are also very high. There is significant anecdotal evidence of China investment in Mexico's northern states. Also, the share of Chinese auto production is growing fast. Chinese firms can be also active trying to find ways to access the U.S. market and diversify their channels. So the next administration will have in Mexico have a very tough time navigating through this interest of both countries and also the tension between the two. In general, I would say the main takeaway from the trip is that, I mean, you have all these nearshoring opportunities that will help increase growth in Mexico, lift growth, improve the economy, also support external accounts. But we shouldn't get too carried away in terms of what could be accomplished by the next government in Mexico as a result of policy changes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Martin. It's been very, very helpful to us. And I appreciate you coming on and discussing your trip, but also broader, just kind of what's happening in Mexico these days.
Great. Thank you very much.
So now it's time for my 3-2-1. That's my three main takeaways from my conversation with Martin Casiano. Two things I'm looking forward to and my one sports fact. So here are my three main takeaways. First is that things are moderately optimistic in Mexico. This seems to be largely due to some of the effect of nearshoring, public and private investment. Martin was very clear on that, and private consumption. Next, that doesn't mean there aren't vulnerabilities, and there are some. There's uncertainty about what to do on monetary policy. There is the problems that can pop up from nearshoring, and then there's the problems that we heard about regarding Pemex, both how it is affecting the potential debt restructuring and also potentially productivity in the country. And the third, of course, is that there's going to be an election in Mexico in June, and it is a pretty big election, but right now there seems to be one clear favorite, which is a continuation of the existing governing party and most likely the same policies. That leads to two things I'm looking forward to. The first is clearly the elections themselves. They're taking place in early June. It's the first opportunity to see a woman as the president of Mexico, whether it is from the current existing party or the main opposition party. So I think that's very exciting. And so we'll be keeping an eye on that. The second is related to the monetary policy question that Martin mentioned. And there is some disagreement within the monetary policy community. How closely do you tie yourselves to the Federal Reserve, or do they need to choose a slightly different path? It's a very important question. It's a hard question for a country like Mexico, which is a much smaller economy, nearer to such a big economy such as the United States. So we'll see how that plays out. And now for my one sports fact, which is to talk about the sport of auto racing. So in the United States, there are basically three big, important auto racing circuits. One is what's called NASCAR. Second is what is called the IndyCars. And the third is Formula One, which is by far the most global of those three. And I want to talk about it because they've all begun within the last week or so. For NASCAR, they actually began in February, and they're an interesting sport because they actually start with what is the equivalent of their Super Bowl, which is the Daytona 500, and then they have their season. In Grand Prix Formula One, they started at the beginning of March in Bahrain, and they will do their global circuit. And then IndyCars will be starting this Sunday in St. Petersburg, Florida. Now, I thought it would be interesting to just think about what is the difference between these cars and circuits, et cetera. And by the way, it's clear that there's lots of other auto racing goes on all over the world, but in the United States, it's these three. So we'll start with the one that's the most global and the most interesting is that it's become very popular here in the United States, which is Formula One racing. It's weird that it's so popular because there has not been a great American driver since I was a kid, actually. And so it's clearly that is not what is attracting people in the United States. What I think attracts people is, first, there was actually a Netflix television show about Formula One racing, which got people interested in it. And secondly, it's just the locales, the amount of money that is spent on these cars. I think each team is allowed to spend up to $135 million on materials and car performance. There's 10 teams. Each team gets two cars. And it's just become a bigger and bigger sport in the United States. Probably even surpassing what is called the Indy cars. The Indy cars are like Formula One cars in that they are called open wheel race cars. They go very fast. Maybe a big difference is a lot of Indy car races are on an oval circuit, whereas Formula One are in kind of a snake-like circuit. Although the IndyCars are very famous for also having road racing as well as just the oval racing, but again, with open wheel race cars. As a kid growing up, the Indianapolis 500 was probably one of the five biggest sporting events in the United States. It's no longer that. It's still a very big sporting event, but it's probably now one of the top 50 sporting events as opposed to one of the top five. It is always interesting to see what happens in those Indy races. And then finally, there's NASCAR. NASCAR is different in that almost every race is run on an oval track. It is not open wheel racing. In fact, it probably looks a little bit more like a sedan. They are known for what's called stock car racing. But the cars are less expensive than the Formula One, but it is still a very, very followed sport, particularly in the southern part of the United States. It's not as popular as it once was, but it is still very interesting. And then maybe one last point is sometimes, of course, In Formula One, oh, actually, in all auto racing, it is the combination of the engineering behind these cars, which can be fascinating and very difficult, of course, and then the drivers themselves. And so the drivers take on big personalities. And so we've seen that over a long period of time. And right now, the biggest driver in the world, by far in all of these races, is the Dutch racer, Max Verstappen, because he seems like he's completely unstoppable. He's won 3 world championships in a row in Formula One. He won the first race this year, and he set a lot of records. But I want to say, mainly because we covered Mexico today, the person who has finished second the most, and the is only the second Mexican to ever win a Formula One race, is Sergio Perez. So is he the person that could actually overturn Max Verstappen? Could Lewis Hamilton do it again? He's won 7 of these world championships in the past. I don't know. He seems like he's unstoppable. Well, anyway, that's going to wrap up this episode of Current Account. I want to thank again my colleague, Martin Cassiano, for joining me today to talk about Mexico. But as always, we'd love to hear your feedback on the show as we constantly look to improve and enhance the experience for you, the listener. We can be reached at podcast@iif.com. All our episodes can be found on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening. And goodbye.